Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It's important to note this is a user fee service, so it is paid for by those facilities.
Jennifer Porter's with the Ag Marketing Service explaining how USDA's beef grading works.
Unlike federal inspection carried out by the Food Safety Inspection Service, grading is not required. So those graders that are there in those facilities, that service is paid for by the plant. So in large facilities, there's enough volume to make that economically work. However, because it's a user fee-driven program, we also have to charge fees for smaller plants when they request grading service. In many cases, that's not on a regular 8-hour-a-day cadence. That's much more as the need arrives in an ad hoc manner. That is very often cost prohibitive for those operations.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
But I think we are talking too much about Donald Trump in Europe, and we should prepare ourselves for a possible second term for Donald Trump by fostering our European competitiveness.
Speaking at the World Economic Forum, Christian Lindner, German finance minister.
Doing our homework is the best preparation for a possible second term of Donald Trump, and this includes our capabilities to defend ourselves, being an attractive partner on eye level when it comes to the economic situation, and when it comes to a fair burden sharing under the roof of NATO, is the best we can do to be in a good partnership with the United States. And then it doesn't matter which administration, if we are attractive, if we do not have to ask others because we have capabilities ourselves, it's the best way to cooperate. And this is completely for both possible outcomes of the election in the United States, doing our homework.
Christine Lagarde is president of the European Central Bank.
The best defense, if that's the way we want to look at it, is attack. And to attack properly, you need to be strong at home. So being strong means having a strong, deep market, having a real single market, and we should be expecting some suggestions by Enrico Letta, former Prime Minister of Italy, who is in charge of producing this report on how we can deepen and improve the functioning of that single market, which is a huge economic zone in the world, but which is not completely a single market yet, as many CEOs, I'm sure, experience on a daily basis. And we should, more importantly, make sure that the money that is saved in Europe or the money that is associated with pension is actually invested in a capital market union that actually functions efficiently to rally the investment that we badly need for the transition towards a greener economy, which relies certainly for a period of time on fossil fuel, but less so, as was indicated in the last COP28, and moves towards renewable, where investment is badly needed.
But Lindner is warning his European counterparts to not follow the U.S.
I'm concerned that some policymakers in the European Union tend to follow the United States to subsidize almost everything. But we have to avoid a subsidy race we cannot afford. I'm curious if the next U.S. administration can continue the way they support the economy. I wonder if it's sustainable to pay so high subsidies. But what we have to do is to improve our framework conditions for our economies and to make further progress in capital markets union. Our competitive disadvantage compared to the U.S. is not subsidies. It's the function of our private capital market.
And when talking trade, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is Director General of the World Trade Organization.
I think the best way to be prepared in the for any eventuality is to focus on those things you need to do anyway. For me at the WTO, I don't fret about who is going to come or what is happening. Maybe that's an overstatement. But in a way, it's focusing on what do we need to do to strengthen and reform the organization so that whatever the circumstance, it will be able to deliver what it's supposed to deliver for people. So if we keep doing that, I think that's a strong answer, a bit of offense in that regard.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We know that for far too long we have been over-reliant on others to supply the fertilizer necessary for crop production.
Speaking earlier in the week at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention in Salt Lake City, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
That's why I'm excited today to make additional announcements in our fertilizer expansion effort. We've identified roughly 90 projects that we're exploring for around $900 million. And today, we're announcing seven more projects that will receive up to $50 million to expand access to additional fertilizer. Expand access to fertilizer that will lower costs. Excited about the opportunities in the Midwest in particular to see this happen. This will now bring to the total of 40 such projects that we have funded through the USDA. And we got about 50 projects yet to be funded. So there's a tremendous opportunity for us to substantially expand access to fertilizer and lower costs for farmers. And many of these projects are farmer-owned, which creates yet another profit opportunity, another entrepreneurial opportunity.
Vilsack has also been focused over the last couple of years on local food systems.
In addition to making us a food secure nation, in addition to the notion that it creates a strong foundation that frees everyone else up to pursue their dreams and their aspirations, which has created this incredibly complex American economy that we're so proud of, it is also rural America that provides more to the country. As I say often to audiences, it also provides the sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters into our military. The people who are willing to risk their lives to protect our freedoms. A disproportionate number come from those small communities. So when I see the loss of farms, and I see the loss of farmland, and I know how difficult and challenging it is from a financial perspective, even though we've enjoyed three best years in net farm cash income in the history of the country, and this year, while it will be a little bit more difficult, will still be above average. The challenge is that the income has become consolidated. In those three record years, 7.5% of American farms, the farms that sell more than $500,000 in sales annually, received about 89% of that income, which meant that nearly 2 million farms had to share 11%. And what we're doing here is creating opportunities for that 92% of farms to be able to have multiple revenue streams so that when they are at that kitchen table and having that conversation with the son and the daughter or the grandson or the granddaughter, and maybe it's a veteran returning from military service, about what's next, I want that conversation to always be, there's tremendous opportunity here. There's an exciting opportunity for you to be entrepreneurial, for you to be engaged in sustainable practices and be rewarded for it, for you to access local markets and be able to be paid more for it, to reduce your costs, to create new renewable energy and less expensive energy, not just for your farming operation, but for everybody in the area. I want there to be excitement and opportunity to be discussed at that table. Because at the end of the day, it is the value system of this country that is represented in this hall today. It is a value system that rewards hard work, that understands that nothing is given, that everything is earned. It is a value system that understands and appreciates the concept of community.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My team and myself, we work so hard year-round trying to get everything ready for CattleCon that by the time you get on site, it's a seamless event. We're basically there to turn the lights on and have a great time. So once we get on site, it's a whole lot of fun making sure that all the cattlemen and women that come out are just having a great old time.
Emily DeSormo is Associate Director of Trade Show and Event Marketing with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. CattleCon 24.
First-timers can experience and expect to really the entire cattle industry under one roof. We have everything from the business meetings and policy meetings and everything like that that's going on one side of the convention. And then we also have the trade show that has all of the latest and greatest technologies, equipment, pharmaceuticals, everything you could have. So between the business that's getting done, the technology that's being rolled out, and the fun events in the evening, there's something for everybody who's in attendance, whether it's their first year or their season CattleCon attendee.
The event, formerly known as the Cattle Industry Convention and NCBA Trade Show, features an event called Cattlemen's College.
Cattlemen's College is definitely an area that I love dearly. I think it's a great opportunity for people really wanting to take that extra step of their operation and in their business. Something new that's actually for 2024, or something that will be new for 2024 this year in Cattlemen's College, is Cattlemen's College will actually take place throughout the week. So it used to be all on the front end before the convention really kicked off. But this year, attendees will be able to enjoy sessions all throughout the week. There'll even be sessions down in the trade show, which will be a first as well. But this is really great. It's a great opportunity to learn more about grazing and repro and genetics and everything in between, and really just take something back with them when they leave Orlando.
A well-known name in the cattle industry, Dr. Clay Mathis, is featured.
Dr. Clay Mathis, who's the department head of animal science at Texas A&M, will actually be the keynote speaker for Cattlemen's College. So he'll be kicking things off on Wednesday with that opening general session for Cattlemen's College. And then we'll have people from Zoetis, we have people from Kansas State, and really all over. So you can definitely expect a lot of great speakers. We're really excited for different things from the herd health side, as well as even a couple tax and finance sessions that are going on. We'll even have one of our own NCBA staffers, Kent Backus, who is the Executive Director of Government Affairs. He'll be doing a Cattlemen's College talk over the current financial planning and tax trends that producers can expect. So there's really something going on all the time, education-wise.
It's also a meeting where producers decide what the policy should be for NCBA.
We'll have everything from NCBA will be meeting to create policies that will take to the Capitol and D.C. to really start making legislation for producers. We're also setting the plans and the roadmap for NCBA as a whole. So whether that's sustainability and the goals that we want to make sure that we're taking to the industry or what we want to take to Washington, there's just definitely a lot of business going on. And then you even have business going down in the trade show. So whether that's a producer's looking to expand their business and they want to get in with different companies, that's an option as well, too.
Speaking of the trade show,
the trade show is definitely my favorite for sure. That's where attendees will find me during CattleCon throughout the week. And we have everything from hands-on sessions, watching clinicians run cattle through the stockmanship and stewardship arena, teaching hands-on education that way. We also have education within the education center that has hands-on sessions and classroom style sessions as well. So there's always something going on, whether it's hands-on or even on a screen.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
When you look at consumption, for instance, around the world, I'm not talking just about the euro area, consumption is still a driving force for growth, but the tailwind that we had the benefit of are gradually fading.
Christine Lagarde is president of the European Central Bank, speaking recently at the World Economic Forum.
This very strange, extremely tight labor market, still tight, but a little less. And some of the indices that we use to identify the relationship, particularly between vacancies and unemployment, are changing gradually. So less tightness on the job market. When we look at savings around the world, there was plenty of it. Excess saving, with that excess saving, pretty much in all advanced economies in particular, is coming down. And from this 10% excess saving, we're getting close to virtually zero. So if you combine these two, job less tight, savings diminishing, clearly consumption is not as strong a force as it used to be. That's one thing. The second thing, which is also beginning to normalize, and I hope Ngozi will talk a lot about that, is trade. Trade went down and was massively disrupted by this goods versus services versus good over the course of the last 2 years preceding 23. But it is beginning now to really pick up. And in October, we had global trade numbers that for the first time in many months was up, and the pattern of trade is changing. But I will leave it to my friend Ngozi to describe that better.
When it comes to trade, though, U.S. not doing anything, David Rubenstein is chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations.
On trade, whoever is elected president is not likely to enter into a lot of trade agreements. The word trade in the United States, or trade agreements, is almost a curse word now. Somebody is in the audience here, Mike Froman, who negotiated the TPP agreement under President Obama, that couldn't even get a vote in the United States Congress. And I don't think any major trade agreement could be approved by our current Congress. And I don't think it's going to change for a while, no matter who the president is, unfortunately, because trade is often seen by certain constituencies in the United States as favoring jobs offshore and not really is very not popular at all. Even Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president, was against the TPP, even though it had been negotiated by a Democratic administration in which she had served. On U.S.-China, U.S.-China is the most important bilateral relationship in the world. There's no doubt about it. But there is no political benefit in the United States about saying anything beneficial or good about China or in a presidential election year. So President Biden and President Trump, I don't think or either one are going to say we need to have closer ties with China and I'm going to be nicer to China than I was before. It's just not going to happen during a presidential election year. Hopefully, after the election's over, the progress that's been made recently at the APEC meeting can see something blossom. But I don't think you'll see anything blossom before then.
But trade has to take a back seat to fiscal responsibility.
Fiscal reform in the United States, very difficult to do. We now have $34 trillion of debt. $34 trillion of debt. The interest on it is approaching our defense budget. And if we don't resolve this in the near future, something's going to happen to the dollar. The dollar has been the only reserve currency for quite some time. But if the United States can't get its fiscal act together, at some point, people are going to do what they did to the British pound and the Dutch guilder years ago when too much money was borrowed by those countries and their currency didn't become as valuable and therefore lost its reserve status. The U.S. doesn't have any real challenger right now to reserve currency status for the dollar, but it will if it keeps doing what it's doing. We have 122% of our GDP in debt, and we are each year our budget deficit is probably about 25% of our spending, and we just can't keep doing that. But there is nobody in the United States government that I see is really seriously addressing that problem, but it will be a big problem in the not too distant future.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We heard loud and clear from producers all across the country. There simply wasn't enough competition.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack addressing members of the American Farm Bureau Federation at their convention in Salt Lake City.
And yes, you can do regulations, and we are. And you can make sure the Department of Justice is alert to concerns about anti-competitive practices, and we're doing that. And we've set up a website for farmers to be able to tell us their stories. But it's also important to invest in more processing capacity. And so I'm excited about what we are doing in this space. We announced the establishment of the meat and poultry expansion, protein expansion effort, processing expansion effort. We funded 35 projects across the United States in 24 states. We're going to continue to see additional awards in the spring. We've provided loan guarantees to expand access not just to processing but to the supply chain that supports processing. Nearly 50 grants have been awarded. We have focused on resources to enable entities and states to provide additional credit for processing. We call this an intermediary relending program. All of that has been established and set up. And we also provided 238 small processing facilities with the ability to do opportunities across state lines.
But when focusing on local food systems, Vilsack said he had a positive story from Colorado.
It was a story of a family that in the 1980s was operating a cattle operation, but they lost the cattle operation during that difficult time, but they were able to preserve the land ownership. They used CRP to basically get them through a tough patch. The next generation, rather than leaving the farm, came to the farm and said, we can be entrepreneurial. We can look for an opportunity to return this industry to the farm and to the family. And so they began a process of engaging in the raising of cattle. And they decided, you know, we need to do business with small processing capacities around the country and around the state, and they did. But several of those were challenged financially, and the family ended up using USDA resources to purchase one of those facilities. And they'd used additional USDA resources to expand that opportunity. So now they're not only benefiting from processing and production, but they're also providing opportunities for their neighbors to be able to have a decent, good viable market. We're investing in value-added producer grants. We're investing in local purchasing opportunities where when government purchases for schools or for food banks that they are purchasing from that local producer. Why is that important? Simply because every time I go to the grocery store and I put a dollar down on the counter, I know that 15 cents of that dollar goes to a farmer. But when I go to a local and regional food system where I'm working directly with my farmer, we have a butcher shop in Waukee, Iowa that we go to as a family, and I know that instead of 15 cents out of every food dollar, that entity is generating 50 cents or 75 cents of every food dollar for those farmers. So this is a combination of efforts to conserve the opportunity for small and mid-sized producers to stay in business.
From Farm Bureau's annual convention in Salt Lake City, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Working through labor issues, I've often said that in the last several years that I feel like the opportunities are endless in production agriculture if you have the labor to carry out those different things.
Matt Bottoms is a producer from Georgia and a member of the Georgia Farm Bureau.
I'm optimistic about markets. I'm optimistic about changing and different things like that. We've just got to figure out how to have the labor to produce. And, you know, there are different companies that are experimenting with robotics and different things like that. And some of those things are maybe out of the price range for the small producer. But it does give the opportunity through various things to have opportunity for growth and expansion.
He's primarily involved in the nursery industry, but how did he get involved in Farm Bureau?
So I got involved in Farm Bureau. It's kind of like, you hear the person say that they were involved 9 months before they were actually here, and that was kind of the case with me. My parents were involved in the Young Farmer Program in the 70s, and so I'm kind of second generation there. My grandfather was on the county board, and my parents were state achievement winners, and so I was kind of born into it, if you will. And as it's funny how things have come full circle. I currently sit on our state board, and I remember when I was getting in late high school and then after college when I came back to the farm, kind of telling my dad, why are you always going to these Farm Bureau meetings? And because we've got work to do here on the farm. So it was probably in my early mid-20s that I really began to see the value as different legislation on labor or different parts of USDA funding and different things that happen, I really began to see that the voice that Farm Bureau has. And, you know, at the end of the day, it is the premier organization in the United States as far as having a voice on the local level, on the state level, and on the national level as well. And so I've just kind of come full circle and really feel like the organization has a lot to offer and the voice that it has for all types of producers, you know, be it small specialty crop producers up to the largest row crop operators or whatever that may be. There's a voice for dairy farmers. There's a voice for nursery. There's a voice for row crop. There's a voice for any kind of agriculture, and that's been rewarding and refreshing.
But how important is it to step up and get involved? Alan Clark, a member of the Idaho Farm Bureau.
I mean, there's a lot of us here today, but there's a lot more farmers out there. As I go and visit my coffee shop or local store where all the farmers gather, they're like, oh, good job, you're doing the work. But, you know, I have my story, but I really can't share their story. And I try to explain to them that, you know, you're growing something different than me. The potato farmer that's growing potatoes, I can't share their story. Or if, you know, their hardship or their successes, I'm not the one to share their stories. It's important that everyone is willing to share their story. And that's what promotion education is. It's at the national level, we're providing resources and kind of ways that we can help pass down through the state and county level ideas on how to share their story to be effective.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
USDA's January beef production forecast for 2024 indicates...
Currently, we have that forecast at 26.1 billion pounds. We raised that this month by 120 million pounds.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jakodowski says higher placement of cattle in feedlots, and that trend expected to continue the first 6 months of 2024, is behind the forecast for more beef production this year. Turning to steer prices, Jakodowski says there were no
noteworthy changes to our steer price forecasts for either 2023 or 2024.
The current price forecast for steers this year is over $178 a hundredweight. Meanwhile, a truing up of data regarding 2023 beef production resulted in a 40 million pound month-over-month increase for last year. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.